At Kelly Companies, it is no secret that they believe in the power of people. In an effort to help their Kellyans get to know each other a little bit better, they decided to launch the Who Do You Know campaign. The goal was simple. Kellyans were encouraged to have a conversation with someone outside of their circle. That's it. These conversations, however, have brought people together and furthered their world-class culture. Shout out to the Kellyans who have made an effort to have meaningful conversations with new friends. You can learn more about those conversations, about those amazing friends, by visiting them online at KeelyCompanies.com.
Welcome to the Live Inspired podcast with John O'Leary. John is the number one national best-selling author of the book On Fire. He's a world-class inspirational speaker, and he's the host of the Live Inspired podcast. John interviews extraordinary individuals on their life story so that you can wake up from accidental living and more fully live your life story. Here's your host, John O'Leary.
Hello, my friends, and welcome to the Live Inspired podcast with John O'Leary. Get ready to buckle up for a wild, inspirational, encouraging, and thought-provoking ride, because for more than a quarter century, that's a long time, Robin Sharma has been devoted to helping others realize their native gifts. As a legendary, world-class, world-renowned personal growth expert, Robin has advised business leaders, superstar athletes, and heads of state to do brilliant work, thrive amidst the change, and realize their highest leadership capabilities. Beyond being a renowned mentor and speaker, Robin's international best-selling books, and they include, you've probably heard of some of these, The Everyday Hero Manifesto, The 5 a.m. Club, The Monk Who Sold His Ferrari, and Who Will Cry When You Die, have influenced millions of individuals around the world to achieve greater success and make a greater impact through their lives. Today, Robin joins us to share his latest book. It's called The Wealth Money Can't Buy, and walk us through the thinking patterns, the daily habits, and the life lessons to build lasting happiness, peak health, career mastery, and a life of serenity. Sounds pretty good. My friends, you're going to leave today's conversation ready to enjoy a genuinely rich life filled with personal power, liberating authenticity, meaningful work, and a lifestyle that will make you feel that fortune has finally smiled upon you. It's going to be a great episode. You're going to love Robin. He's my buddy. So Robin Sharma, without further ado, come on, baby, turn that microphone on. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Live Inspired podcast. My friend, now yours, his name, Robin Sharma. Robin, welcome to Live Inspired with John O'Leary.
John, it's a real pleasure. Thank you for having me on your show.
Well, it's our honor. And as I said right before we hit record, I've been looking up to you for a long time. I respect the work that you do, and I'm not the only one who respects the work that you've done. For a few of our listeners who might be tuning in who say, Robin Sharma, that name sounds familiar, but I can't place it. How do you like to introduce yourself when you meet someone in an airport or a grocery store or in front of a barista and they say, Robin, tell me about you? How do you respond to that?
Wow, what a great question. I would say human being, family man, hopefully a humble servant, writer, speaker, content creator. Someone who loves beauty, I would probably say that.
Where do you find beauty?
More than ever before, John, in human interactions. I was in London before I came here to LA. Had a fantastic conversation with a taxi driver. They're psychologists on four wheels. They met so many people. They have so much wisdom to share. On the weekend, I had a conversation with a gardener at the hotel I was staying at. Talked about his dream of owning his own business, how he lives in a faraway city and he commutes. But he's with the flowers and he does his work with great pride and great honor. I mean, I think that's beautiful. A conversation with a fellow human being where you hear their story and listen to their dreams and do whatever we can to help them feel seen in a world where a lot of people don't feel seen, where they feel disconnected. I think that's beauty. I find beauty in food. I had a nice sushi meal last night that was tasted very, very beautiful. I love going to art galleries. I love art because I think the stardust of the creator can rub off on us. And I didn't mean that in a spiritual way, but I think maybe at some level I meant to.
Yeah. Well, we're glad that you see the beauty, and in some regards, more importantly, that you share it. And I think that's one of your great gifts, is that you identify it out there, but you remind the rest of us that it's there for us too, if we choose. So I'm going to back a little bit out of that sushi diner and away from the art gallery for a moment. You were born in Africa, but you grew up in Canada. We could spend the entire podcast just talking about your childhood. I don't want to spend a ton of time there, but I think the man you became is influenced in no small part because of the boy you were and the parents who raised him. Tell us about your mother and what she was like for you growing up.
I really appreciate you, John. I don't get asked questions like this a lot. Usually it's about the content. And I'd be very happy to tell you about my mother. I just had dinner with her and my dad, who's going to be 87 next month. He was a family doctor for 54 years. I said, when he retired, Dad, why did you stay in the profession so long? He said, my patients needed me, son. I talk a lot about my dad in my books, and my mom always goes, well, you know, what about me? So I'm glad you...
Well, that's why I started with your poor mother, who's always left behind in the wake, but I know she's an equal to your dad. So I wanted to hear about her first.
She is a titan. She is an elegant, loving, strong human being. She was a school teacher for many years. She grew up in Kenya. She is so wise. You know, one of the things she used to say to me was, what's yours is yours and cannot be taken away from you. If we lose a relationship or we get disappointed on an opportunity, mom would say, well, it wasn't yours. And what's yours can't be taken away from you. Mm. A lot of wisdom. You know, they're like mom-isms. What's yours is yours, can't be taken away from you. Nothing succeeds like success. Yeah, she's just got a lot. She's got a lot of wisdom and a lot of grace. And I love her very, very much.
She was an educator?
Educator.
And married a physician. Where did they meet?
They met in Nairobi, I believe, in Kenya.
And quickly take me through the path that led them ultimately to the eastern part of Canada.
Canada was a land of openness and great opportunity at the time. When I mean openness, it was just like everyone was just pouring in and there was just abundant opportunity. My dad was a young doctor and he heard about this place called Canada that was looking for doctors. I wrote about this in my last book before the new one, The Everyday Hero Manifesto, how hard it was for him to get into medical school. I mean, he'd been given a seat because he was a very good student and he had to travel by foot for 3 days. And then when he got there, they'd given away his seat in medical school. So anyway, he became a young doctor in this province of Canada called Nova Scotia, on an island off of Nova Scotia called Cape Breton. That's where I grew up. It's a little town of about 5,000 people. Not much happened, but that's where I was raised.
I've read that you were interested in music as a kid, that you thought you might become a musician. What happened, man? Where did you make the wrong turn?
I know. I should have been, I should have been in a rock band. You've done amazing preparation. It's quite impressive to see your level of preparation and rigor. And that's not very common, John. And I just want to celebrate you for your attention to your craft. It's very inspiring. Yes, I was... It's true. I loved music and I was a guitar player. I don't think I had a natural facility to play guitar, but I played in a band and at some level I thought about perhaps doing something interesting, but destiny had other interests for me to follow.
Ultimately, you end up where you're supposed to, but I'm from a family of attorneys, my grandfather, my father, two of my siblings. So law whispered my name, but I chose to move in an opposite direction. At what point did you realize law was whispering your name and you decided to follow it for a season? What happened there?
Well, I grew up in a family where there were two encouragements. It was either become a doctor or a lawyer.
Right.
From an early age, I just, okay, I'm gonna be a doctor or a lawyer. And I was always more of an artist than a scientist. And so I said, well, out of those two, let me become a lawyer. I started reading about it, go to courtroom cases when I was in my teen years, got to law school, became a lawyer, became successful. I was a litigator, but very, very empty. Wake up in the morning, look in the bathroom mirror, didn't really like the person looking back at me, which led me on a personal odyssey of sorts.
Robin, did you feel that way before law school and graduation and then serving as an attorney? Or was that something that you felt, no, man, I realized I was in the wrong profession at that time?
I don't know if the study of law was my bliss. You know, I have this concept that I teach called joy is a GPS. If you trust your joy, it'll be a GPS of sorts. The people who make you feel joyful are the people you're meant to be with. The people who steal your joy and the energy vampires you need to release. The activities that fill you with joy naturally are where your instinct wants you to be. I liked the study of law. If I didn't have to read the legal cases, I'm not sure I would. Now, right, in the field of leadership, personal development, human greatness, I read it all the time. I consume it. I love it. Last night, I was reading about Nobu, the founder of the Nobu sushi restaurants. But I think it was really in the practice of law that I realized, you know, I got to this place. I thought I would wake up happy. I thought it was going to make me successful. But what's the point of worldly success if you've lost your soul and your spirit and your joyfulness along the way?
Many don't recognize that till they hit a moment in their life when they can't make that U-turn. They can't pivot left or right. You began to recognize that in your early 20s, and by 25, you had already started to chart a new path forward. I would imagine, though, in a family of physicians and doctors where there were two choices and you chose one of them, there was not a third, but you're about to choose it anyway. Was that met with some challenges at home when you're like, you know, Mom, Dad, I'm thinking about becoming an author. I'm going to really pivot here.
I would have expected my parents would have been concerned. And over the years, they've told me how concerned they actually were. I mean, I resigned from my position as a litigator. Yet, they were nothing but encouraging. I'll tell you a quick aside, John. I started off self-publishing my first book, self-published The Monk Who Sold His Ferrari. And it really started from incredibly humble beginnings. Did it in a Kinko's copy shop. I would go to different bookstores and leave 5 copies on consignment. And there was one bookstore in my neighborhood. I still remember the name. It was called The Bookseller. And for some reason, the book was always on the bestseller list. So I was thinking, like, what is it? But it was encouraging to me. You know, I'm a self-published author and the book is just keeps on selling in other places. It was kind of off to a slow start, but this bookstore in my neighborhood was flying. So I would go in there, I'd leave 5 more books. I'd look, there it was, number 6 on the bestseller list, top 10. So I went, wow. And only last year, I believe it was, Dad said, that was an amazing bookstore, The Bookseller. Like, oh yeah, it was like, and the book was always selling well there. And he goes, yeah, that's because I was buying the books. So he was encouraging.
He wasn't the only one ultimately who would be buying those books. When did you recognize that this little self-published book that only your father was buying at first was ultimately going to be bought by a few more individuals, then a few more, then ultimately go mainstream?
It sounds so simple, but instinct is so much more powerful than intellect.
Tell me what that means. What does instinct mean?
Instinct, the principle is, instinct is more powerful than intellect, and intellect is the knowledge that the world has taught us to believe about what's possible. George Bernard Shaw said, the reasonable man adapts himself to the world, the unreasonable one persists in adapting the world to himself. Therefore, all progress depends on the unreasonable man, or obviously woman. And so intellect is the world, the status quo, telling us what's possible and teaching us how to think. Instinct is the deeper wisdom that lies in the core of every single one of us. And we might have a crazy idea, but you know, my idea to write this book and get the message out there, people laughed at The Monk Who Sold His Ferrari. What a silly title. What a silly idea. You had a legal career. You're giving it up. But my instinct was really very, very strong. And so I just believed in it. And I started off small. And there wasn't one inflection point, John. But people started reading the book and buying 10 copies for everyone they knew. And then companies started asking me to speak. And then my publisher told me, oh, it's the fifth best-selling book in the history of Israel. And it's on the Japanese bestseller list and Colombia and Latin. And it's this invisible set of hands that helped me along. Mm.
The message within that book, for those who have not read it, if you had to condense it down into a sentence or two, what is it?
It's the hero story. The lawyer is in his world of busyness. Look at the world we live in now. A lot of us are busy being busy. We've given up on our childhood dreams. We've lost the sparkle in our eye. He took a heart attack in the middle of a packed courtroom. That was his inflection point. Gave it all up, went to the Himalayas, heard about this band of sages, learned their philosophy, returned to his former life, transformed. And I guess the point to be of service to your many followers and viewers is we all live the hero story. When we were kids, we were intimate with our genius and our gifts and our talents. We trusted ourselves. We trusted people. We had dreams. And then life closes us. Mm. And what life closes us, and it causes us to disbelieve in possibility and get disconnected with our primal genius and forget about how to be brave and how to be imaginative and how to be loving. And I mean, that's why I wrote The Wealth Money Can't Buy. I think it's the most valuable book I've written in 31 years. And I think it's because this world has taught us that money will bring happiness. And I think money is important, but it's only one of the eight forms of wealth.
In a moment, we'll be talking about all eight of those forms of wealth, but I'm not going to let you off the hook that easy. We're not going to go there quite yet. The demand for your book, I'm just blown away by how quickly it elevated and how broadly and how well it was received. And this at a time really before YouTube and social media and all the forms that we can use now to really drive messaging wasn't there. So it was really done one-to-one-to-one. What is the ache you think in the human heart that this little book was filling back in the late 90s and early 2000s and since that it helped alleviate and helped give some encouragement and hope and clarity around what the next step might be?
It's the same ache that too many good souls have in their hearts right now. I believe we have a heroic self and an egoic self. The heroic self is our true nature. The heroic self is brave. The heroic self is wise. The heroic self knows how we should live. The heroic self is a giver, not a taker. The heroic self is resilient. You have some pictures of MLK on your wall. It's a great example of the heroic self. Mother Teresa. Nelson Mandela, 27 years in a prison cell, and he turned his suffering into wisdom. And when he was released, he invited the prosecutor who wanted the death sentence for him to dinner, and he invited the jailer who kept him in prison to his inauguration. Yeah. So we all have a heroic self, all of us. But as we go through life and we experience micro trauma and macro trauma and the messaging and programming from the herd, we start to shut ourselves down and we forget who we truly are. And this creates a self-betrayal. We lose ourselves and we buy the house, we get the mortgage, we get the job, we live in the world, but we know deep inside there's this fundamental longing for us to be true to ourselves, for us to know true joy, for us to create something with a purpose, for us to lift up other lives. We all have these human longings. It's what makes us human. But we forget about them in the busyness of the world. And I think why people connected with the monk who sold his Ferrari is just reminded people of what we're meant to be.
I think part of the reason why we don't remember who we are supposed to be or who we once knew we were before the world told us who we were supposed to be is because we're busy and we're distracted. So I'm going to walk you through four quotes that I've written down from speeches you've given and books that you've written that moved me deeply. By the way, I started this list with about 100, and it took all of my red ink in the world to condense it down to four to make sure I get you out of here on time. But the first quote, Robin, is the addiction to distraction is the death of your creative production. I'm going to say it again. The addiction to distraction is the death of your creative production. What does that mean?
It means you can play with your phone or change the world. You can't do both. It means that too many good people are spending their finest hours doom scrolling and watching shiny toys and missing out on the finest moments that they're never going to get back. I think it means that a lot of good people are not living their potential because they're suffering from broken focus syndrome. We just live in a world where a lot of, well, let's not confuse busy with productivity, and let's not confuse movement with progress. And yet a lot of us really are, we're just always distracted, and we're addicted to the white screen. We're addicted to chit chat. We're addicted to chasing every once in a lifetime opportunity. I think the people who make beautiful lives and beautiful work, these people are monomaniacally focused on a few things. These people are minimalists versus maximalists.
What do you mean they're minimalist rather than maximalist?
If you look at almost any great creator, they had an obsession with the masterwork. I call it your Project X. See, we live in a world right now, you talked about content, and we're in a rush to push out 1,000 videos, let's say. Why not spend a year and push out a piece of magic? Because the marketplace rewards the pushing of magic. So I live in Italy, and it's a land of great artists. Michelangelo spent 4 years working on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. If you look at a lot of the great authors, they spent years working on their books. Look at the Taj Mahal, 22 years. The Great Pyramid of Giza, one of the 7 wonders of the world, 2,500 blocks, 50,000 workers to create the wonder of the world. So I believe being a minimalist, saying, I'm going to do one masterwork that will disrupt the marketplace and astonish people, and spending a year, 2, 3, 4 years on it versus 50 things. In the book, I talk about the 3 great friends rule. I'd rather have 3 great friends and go deep versus wide with 10,000 social media friends. And then just even building your life. I believe build your life around what I call the big 5. 5 priorities, not 50 priorities. And it sounds so obvious, but then you have a lot of free time. And the things you do, you do incredibly well because you're not chasing every shiny toy.
So good. So the second quote is, it's easier to behave your way into a new way of thinking than to think your way into a new way of behaving.
It's a psychological principle. We all want to rewire ourselves to get to our next best versions of ourselves. Meditation is very powerful. Thinking yourself into becoming braver, more excellent, more kind, more generous is powerful. But as straightforward as it sounds, going out there into the world today and modeling the person you wish to become is training for installing those virtues. So there's a concept I teach called micro bravery. Going out there and creating scenarios where you push yourself to be more brave is how you build bravery. One thing I talk about is eating alone once in a while. Like a lot of us, we would rather get a root canal than eat alone because we feel judged, or we feel like we don't have anyone to have dinner with. But it's very powerful to go into a restaurant that's full on a Saturday night and leave your phone at home.
Yeah, agreed.
And eat, right? And just have people looking at you like you're someone who doesn't have anyone. And leave your phone and just sit there and enjoy the meal. That's bravery training. So it's easier to behave your way into a new way of thinking than think your way into a new way of behaving as a psychological tool to become a more powerful, stronger person.
We had a hot date, my wife and I. So this is not exactly the micro bravery you're referring to, but it's a whisper of it. We had a hot date on Friday night this past weekend, and both of us forgot our phones at home. And it was one of the better dates that I can remember because neither one of us, and we're pretty good about keeping the phones off and certainly off the table and on vibrate. But still, when you feel a vibration against your leg, you're going to at least feel it, if not reach for it. And to have utterly zero distractions while we are out together is a rarity in this world. And it was an awesome date because of it. So it leads us perfectly, by the way, Robin, into the third quote. This is how God sets things up sometimes. Victims love entertainment, leaders love education. What does this one mean?
You can tell a victim a mile away because they give their power away to external things. Victims are all about CBE, complaint, blame, and excuse. Leaders are all about APR, absolute personal responsibility. So I think you can make excuses or you can live your finest life. You can't do both. And I think victims, in so many ways, they love entertainment. Nothing wrong with entertainment. I love film, for example. But victims, they want the rewards of world class, but they're not willing to do what world class requires. And I'm not judging, but I think they're just so frightened of getting in the game. They're frightened of their powers. They're frightened about change. And so they make complaints and blame and they excuse. But leaders and great entrepreneurs, I know many members of your Live Inspired community, it's all about APR, absolute personal responsibility, installing the right habits, taking the action, continuing when you feel like giving up. And I think the world needs more leaders right now versus entitled people who are expecting the world will give them great lives.
And to the friends who now respond by saying, Robin, you have no idea what I've been through. You don't know about the fire, the divorce, the bankruptcy, the parents that raised me or did not raise me, the spouse who left me, the children who disappoint me, the world that I live in over here in this part of the, whatever the example might be. What do you say to those who respond and you don't know my life, man?
Very powerful question. I want to say this as respectfully as I can. I would say, you don't know my life either. We all go through tragedy. We all experience triumph. It's the human journey. Just because we experience difficult times doesn't mean we have to give away our power to past events. The past can become a prison we live in or a school we learn from. And I think the greatest of human beings turn their suffering into strength and they use their pain as purification. And so someone's been through a hard time. I've been through incredibly hard times. And I don't know if it's a reason to stay stuck in the past and say, this happened to me. And because of that, I'm bitter. Or because of that, I didn't launch the business. Or because of that, I'm not living my finest life. I mean, I think you're, from what little I know about you, but you're a masterclass in resilience.
Well, I appreciate that. And I better quickly reflect the praise back your way or I will start getting a big head and a large ego, which ties into our fourth quote before we open up your most recent book. A bad day for the ego is a great day for the soul.
That's a proverb of sorts. And it's exactly what we're talking about.
All right.
So when you're going through a micro problem or a macro tragedy, what does the ego say? Get me out. This is bad. Why me? Boo hoo. But it's those difficulties that introduce us to our strengths. Rumi said it very well. He said, keep breaking your heart over and over again until it opens. So if we choose, a very painful time in our life can be the very difficulty that teaches us how strong we are, that teaches us gentleness and wisdom, makes us kind, that makes us brave, that causes us to be so fearless, we don't care about what the critics think. And I find it interesting. I mean, you seem to be a man who's studied a lot of the wise lives. I find it very interesting, John, that the kindest people and the greatest humanitarians, most egoless of leaders, they're all the ones who have suffered the most.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think suffering can either break you or it can grow you. I mean, there are a lot of people who go through tragedy and they never recover from it. And there are some people who go through extreme tragedy and it makes them special and it introduces them to their gifts and their talents and their genius. And there's a lot of tools we can use that I wish they'd teach in school,
right.
Whether it's MVP, it's my acronym for meditation, visualization, and prayer, which I try to do from 4 to 5 every morning before I work out, writing in a journal. a time-honored way to build commitment, to build self-knowledge. And when I've gone through painful times, sometimes I remember one period in my life, over a period of about a month, I wrote 1,000 pages processing through my pain, metabolizing my emotions so that I didn't carry them with me. And so they didn't create this shadow self that Carl Jung talks about that comes to bite you back in hidden ways.
I have a friend named Don Eggleston who says, what is not transformed is transmitted.
What is not transformed is transmitted. It's very powerful. What does that mean to you?
We were driving by an electrical station and he was talking about how these transformers work and how they take electricity and distill it down and make it so we're actually in our homes and apartments, we can flip on a switch and it will actually work. Otherwise, it would be this robust explosion of electricity when you tried that. It's a transformer. And with humans, if we aren't able to transform our hardship from the past or our disappointments and heartache, we'll always be acting it out going forward. It just transmitted forward. The same broken, the same record that we received is the one we'll give to others.
Yeah, it makes me think of the idea, and I hadn't planned to go here, but heal what hurt you so you don't bleed on people who didn't cut you. And what I take away from your friend's statement is, if you don't transform the pain into power, if you don't transform the hurt, the hardship, it could be a business loss, a loss of a business partner, could be a loss of a life partner, could be loss of a parent. But if you don't work with it and process through it, then you're going to carry it and it's going to create what I call in my methodology, the field of hurt. And you transmit it to everyone that you meet. You transmit it to everyone that you meet. They feel it. Mm-hmm. So it affects the sales meeting. You're working on a creative project. You're not intimate with your creativity because you've got this block. You don't have energy. You don't have wellness. All because you haven't transformed all of those emotions from the difficulty into magic and heroism and bravery and good health.
Well, you helped me transform over the weekend. I read a book with hundreds and hundreds of chapters, and it was not Atlas Shrugged or some other long book. It was your most recent book, The Wealth Money Can't Buy. I guess my first question is, why write this? You've done so much work already. You've poured your heart onto so many pages and through so many projects already. Why another book?
Well, first of all, this is my oxygen. Writing is my oxygen. Secondly, I want to serve my readers. And thirdly, I think our society has created a cultural hypnosis that has taught us that wealth means accumulating a huge amount of money. So we put the billionaire on the pedestal, but the person with the great family life or the great inner life or a life of great adventure is dismissed. I've mentored a lot of super rich people who are cash rich, but life poor. Mm. And so I believe there are actually 8 forms of wealth. And I want to be super clear, John, money is only one of those forms of wealth. But money is one of the forms of wealth, no question. Gives freedom, allows you not to be backed in the corner to make choices you don't want to make, allows you to do incredible things for your family. But there are 7 other forms of wealth that I wanted to share with as many people as possible, because I think a lot of people, consciously or subconsciously, are spending their days chasing a mountain that I predict will cause them to feel they climbed the wrong mountain.
Yeah.
Right? Money and material, like, it's important, no question. But it's not going to make you happy. It's not going to bring you fulfillment. It's not going to give you a rich heart.
I had the honor of being a hospital chaplain for 3 years in my late 20s. And in one of the visits, I was with an older guy, former business owner, who talked about all the things he gained along the way and all the things he lost as he neared the tippity top. Talked about the choice to handle stress with drugs, which cost him his marriage and the relationship with his 3 girls, ultimately his health. And now at the very end of his life itself. And he looked out the window, Robin, and then looked back at me and said, John, I've climbed to the very tippity top. I've made it to the very top. I rung the bell. And now I've realized I leaned the thing against the wrong damn wall. And I think you are reminding us that, yeah, money's part of it. And yet it's not the pursuit of it ever, or even the accomplishment and the gain of it that will fill us. So you laid out money as a piece of it, but also 7 others. I won't walk through all 8 today, but I do want to go through a couple and then have you share a few stories around each. One section is on wellness. And there are several chapters within it. But one chapter in particular was on, around this commitment of taking a dopamine detox. Why is it valuable as we pursue wellness to take a dopamine detox?
Well, we've become addicts. We've become a society of addicts. We watch a 3-second video. There's a release of the neuroregulator dopamine. The thing about dopamine is the more we experience it, the more we want it. And so we get addicted to our phone. I'm sure you know this, but the people who created a lot of the social media platforms studied the slot machines in Las Vegas. That's why it scrolls down like that. So I believe technology is a fantastic servant. I wouldn't be talking to you if I didn't have technology, but it's a tragic master. Mm. And so in that, the wellness is the second form of wealth. And in the chapter you speak about, I'm suggesting go on a dopamine detox for 7 days or 10 days. Don't check social media. Don't watch attractive TV shows. Don't do anything overstimulating. And do something, what a concept, read a book for 2 hours every night. Have a family dinner with no technology. Go for 3-hour long walks in the woods. Here's a concept. Be alone for a day without any technology. I just believe that solitude is the new luxury good. And so I think it's really important to put down the phone and be alone. I'll put down the phone and have a conversation with another human being. Now, I think everyone we meet has a story to tell, a lesson to teach, and a dream to share if we have the ears to be open to them. And if we could just, you talked about your wife and the hot date, to use your term. You gave her and she gave you something that is so precious. And that's the gift of presence. Mm. We give our family, our family wants the gift of presence. Our customers want the gift of our presence. Our work wants the gift of our presence. And that's the world we live in. We are pulled in so many different directions. We're checking our phones or we're not present. So it's a great gift you gave your wife, and I'm sure you give to everyone in your social circle.
If you and I had more time together, I would ask you about chapter 42 and the story of your mother confronting a motorcycle gang. But I'm going to save that one for a one-to-one coffee sometime with you. I'm looking forward to hearing more about it. It was a great moment. I could just see this lady in her 8th decade about to have that conversation for another time, though. A fourth theme that you write about is the gift of your craft, the work that you do. And in chapter 90, you introduced me to a guy that I'd never heard of before named Kenny Sailors. Who is Kenny Sailors and why in the world would you write about him in chapter 90?
Kenny Sailors is the creator of the jump shot in basketball. Now it's ubiquitous. Everyone knows about it. But when he did it, it was a revolutionary act to actually jump off the floor and take a shot. So he became a greatly admired sports hero. And then I believe he went to the military and served his country. And then he went to Alaska and lived a simple life with his wife. And after she passed away, I believe from Alzheimer's, he taught basketball to young kids. And when he was asked about his Final Four, as you know, Final Four basketball, I believe it's the Final Four teams that get into the championship round or the ending, one of the late rounds before the championship. He talked about his Final Four was his family and his country and these two other things, and not once did he talk about his work. Now, paradoxically, that story ends the section on the fourth form of wealth, which is craft. And I believe deeply in the importance of mastery and pushing your Project X. I call that your master work out into the world. I think it's so important to do work at your best and take great pride in it because it's a great source of happiness and a wealth money can't buy. Having said that, I think a lot of us define ourselves by our work. And so I ended with the Kenny Sailors story to remind us that work is incredibly important. It gives us psychic income. It allows us to astonish our consumers. Having said that, there are things that are more important to a great life aside from work.
That story was beautiful. The creation of the jump shot, the service to the nation, the fact that at the end of his life, that he asked for the Final Four, and a man who'd done so much professionally and changed a sport, forgot to mention both. I mean, it's a telling story. You end your book with the idea of service, that this will ignite a truly wealthy life when you serve. And I thought about asking you around the final chapter, the second final chapter, but I think it's the one right before that, which was around Alexander the Great. And I'm assuming this is a true story. It's unbelievable if it is, to memorialize and to remember the three things that Alexander the Great wanted when he passed away. Will you tell our listeners and our viewers what those three things are as we wrap up our time together on the podcast?
Well, many people know Maslow's hierarchy of human needs. And for anyone who might not be aware of it, he created this. He was an eminent psychologist, and he created this pyramid or a hierarchy of human needs. And at the lower levels, he had things like safety needs and personal needs. We need food in our bellies. We need a shelter over our heads. Those are the fundamental needs for us as human beings to survive. As we take care of those lower level needs, we can move to the higher reaches of our human hungers. And at the top, he put self-actualization. Once we have food in our bellies, work, shelter, et cetera, community, we can get to that pinnacle of his hierarchy, which is actualizing our gifts and our talents, getting to know our primal genius, becoming all we're meant to be. A lot of people don't know this, but before he died, he actually put another tier above self-actualization. And he said this was the highest of all human beings. And he called it self-transcendence. And that's the eighth form of wealth. It's to live for a cause that's larger than yourself. And when you can do that, no matter what you do, gardener, codener, coder, yoga teacher, airline pilot, astronaut, podcaster, CEO, if you can live for a mission that is bigger than your own needs, you find a secret of happiness and purpose and resilience and mastery that very few people could find. One of the important points about being of service is to remember the shortness of life. And so live with a sense of mortality. And that brings me to that chapter you mentioned. Memorize Alexander the Great's last three wishes. And he basically said, he told his generals that when he died, he had three wishes. Number one, that only the world's best doctors should carry his coffin. Number two, that the vast economic wealth, the gold and jewels that he had gathered over his entire lifetime, be strewn on the funeral procession's path. And thirdly, that his hands should hang open outside of the coffin. So his generals said, why? And he said, first, he wanted everyone there to see that the finest doctors carry the coffin so they would realize that even the greatest medicine available had no power to prevent a human being from dying. Number two, he wanted the streets to be littered with his gold and other forms of financial fortune, so everyone in attendance will understand that money made on earth remains on earth after we die. And finally, he said he wanted his hands outside the coffin so his followers would know and never forget that we are born with nothing and we die empty-handed. I think those are three wishes worth remembering as we journey through a lifetime.
Robin Sharma, it moved me deeply to be reminded of those lessons and by the teacher who taught them to me over the weekend and has been teaching me lessons on life for a lot longer than that. We wrap up every one of our podcasts with seven quick fire questions. So here we go. Live Inspired 7 with Robin Sharma begins with, for a man who's written many books, this one will be hard for you. But what's been the most impactful book you've ever read?
The Prophet by Khalil Gibran.
Great book. What's one positive characteristic or one trait that you possessed as a little boy growing up in Canada that you wish you exhibited as brilliantly today?
Wow, that's such a hard one. I would say just dancing in the moment without caring what anyone would think.
If your home caught fire, your apartment, your condo, wherever you're staying, and all living things are out, and you have an opportunity of running back in and grabbing one item, one physical thing, what's the physical thing you would run in and safely save?
Someone gave me a first edition of The Prophet by Khalil Gibran. Important book to me. Maybe that. If not that, my journals.
If you could sit on a bench on a gorgeous day, whether it's in Los Angeles or Italy or St. Louis, Missouri, where I live, and have a long conversation with anyone living or deceased, who would you like to be seated next to?
I would say Jean-Michel Basquiat. I would say Nelson Mandela. And I absolutely have to say Michelangelo and Da Vinci.
It's a crowded bench, but a good one. What's the best advice either those leaders or anyone else ever gave you? So the best advice Robin Sharma has ever received is?
Oh my goodness. Run your own race. Be helpful to as many people as possible. Oh, and the Japanese proverb, get knocked down 7 times, get up 8.
What advice would you offer to yourself at age 20? So if you could sneak back in time a couple years and whisper some wisdom your way at age 20, what would that be?
Train yourself to get up at 5 a.m. and spend an hour at least exercising, praying, visualizing, writing in a journal, and meditating. Second thing I would say to my 20-year-old self, remember that the opinions of others are nothing more than the opinions of others. Trust your instinct. It's wiser than your head. Third thing I'd say is a red flag is a red flag. You can get into a lot of trouble seeing a red flag in someone and hoping it's green. Mm. And I mean, I could go on, but I'd say the final thing I'd say to my 20-year-old self is the human who helps the most people wins.
Robin Sharma, it has been said that all great people can have their lives summed up in one sentence. How would you like yours to read?
You know, I have to be honest with you, John. That speaks to legacy, and I don't believe in legacy anymore. I think legacy is about ego, like how will you be remembered? So I don't really, I want to say this politely, but it doesn't matter how I'm going to be remembered because I'll just be a pile of dust on a mantle above a fireplace next to some soccer trophies. I just want to help as many people as possible and enjoy a good life while I can.
I think that might be how you remember then. Here is this man who traveled the world, who wrote books that influenced millions, who spoke around the world and consulted with some of the biggest organizations, but who was humble and loved the one in front of him and was a great son. Great leader, great father, great person. So Robin Sharma, thank you for spending some of your time, some of your life with us. It has been an awesome time for us.
John, you're a gentleman. I congratulate you and salute you for the movement you've built around Live Inspired and all the lives you're touching and just the humanity you brought to this interview. I mean, it means a lot, and I look forward to more conversations together.
My friends, that is the great Robin Sharma. My name is John O'Leary, and today is your day. What a gift. Live inspired.
Well, my friends, it is no wonder why Robin Sharma is one of the top leadership experts and one of the most widely read authors in the world. He's a big deal, and he took time out of his big, busy schedule to spend it with us today. So cool. Now, throughout our conversation, I jotted down a bunch of notes. I'm sure you were taking notes where you are as well. And I'll have all of them in the show notes. You know where to find those at johnoleary.com/podcast. They'll be right there for you. But if you're asking me, O'Leary, come on, man, give us one of the notes you wrote down. Here's one that I put a little star next to. It's easier to behave your way into a new way of thinking than to think your way into a new way of behaving. That's a big deal. I'm going to say it again because I don't think we really fully embrace the gift of this one. Here it comes. It is easier to behave your way into a new way of thinking than to think your way into a new way of behaving. In what area of your life might that benefit you, my friends? Whether it's in a relationship, something going on professionally, something going on spiritually, something taking place in your physical health, do we need to behave our way into a new way of thinking? It's one of more than a dozen things that I wrote down from the conversation today. Another word that I wrote down was dopamine-detox. Robin encouraged us to take a dopamine detox and to get away from technology at least partially throughout the course of a day and maybe even to take a full day off. Well, way back in 2022, a lifetime ago for some of us, I welcomed award-winning science journalist and screen life balance expert. Her name is Catherine Price onto the Live Inspired podcast. Catherine shares her evidence-backed resources to help us design lives where we control technology rather than the other way around. Wouldn't that be nice if actually we controlled the technology rather than the technology controlling us? If you want to learn more about the conversation with Catherine Price and what it means for you and taking a dopamine detox or elevating your life going forward, check it out. It's a great one at episode 470. It's my episode with Catherine Price. Or you can just let your fingers do the walking right now. Cruise on over to johnolearyinspires.com/podcast. My friends, I want to thank you for being part of our Live Inspired podcast community. I want to remind you that the foundation is firm, that the headwind might be real, but that the best is indeed yet to come. So for this time and until next time, my name is John O'Leary. Today is your day. What a gift. Live Inspired.
You know that Keeley Companies is all about fostering the world-class culture through their incredible cultural pillars. Well, it was time to add a seventh cultural pillar, Keeley Green. Guided by the mission to raise the sustainability standards by which they design, build, operate, and live, Keeley Green is dedicated to using a holistic approach to leave a positive impact on our environment, create a future that is sustainable for generations to come. In the words of Rusty Keeley, we are just getting started. You can learn more about that just getting started mentality and all the work they do by visiting my friends at Keeley Companies online at keeleycompanies.com.